Dr. Borg. Yeah. Okay, so in 1957.
So 1957, I think that's the last where we got our throats cut here. Mm-hmm. 1957, we organized with trying not to confuse any more confusion in this world about a group of people. A group of people who speaks a different language called the Muscogees, and another group of people called the Miccosukees. But in 57, we needed to become federally recognized, so we put the two together, and our own people started lobbying. And in a 24-hour stretch from back in those 57, you didn't have too much good of transportation. The roads weren't all that healthy. But our own Indian boys saw the light that if we're going to need federal assistance because of the years that we never had federal assistance, we need to assimilate and become known as a Seminole tribe of Florida. They didn't really care what the names are. If they became the natives of Florida, but it just happens that we chose a name Seminole Tribe of Florida, so that engulfs two different groups of people to be assimilated as one group, as known as Seminoles. Japan was kind of defeated back in the 40s. Korea, I don't know if they ever beat them, but Germany, they did something over there. What happens, why some of our people get very bitter, is that they did all their slaughtering in these big countries, and they go back and they reestablish it. MacArthur came out with a perfect feasibility study on how to develop Japan again because of the human bodies over there. And it became an empire and some sort of development, building trade. And they put billions and billions of dollars in turn. They also made billions and billions of dollars to help their own people. The beer that I drank the other day, the can went back to Japan and came back, and I rebought that beer can again as a little monkey or something. I don't know. I've seen it slapping his hand a couple of times. But anyway, Germany looked like got kind of devastated a little bit, and they pour back money into it. But the American Indians, just my group, now the other country, they can fight for their own behalf. My group down here was only 200. What possible economic gains can it give the United States of America? Really not a damn thing. Can't even make a... If I died today, it's not going to make your... You'll probably say, oh yeah, I knew it. There's no impact that I've made. Now, if I had the yellow powder called uranium and I figure out how to make an atom bomb awfully quick, I'd make a few people jump. But unfortunately, I don't have uranium. Maybe I would go sabotage somebody and get some. So, 1,500 people, I can see 1,500... I can almost see 1,500 people in my bingo hall. All of my tribal members. Matter of fact, I can. There's no really economic gains that the United States could possibly do. So what they did is they refined the name Department of Interior from Department of War, which we used to belong to. And then it was under another thing. Now we're in the Department of Interior, and they probably put it to something else. Because it's just a group of little cloud there that still haunts the United States. And it's a group of Indians in the United States that really cannot... But some tribes are starting to get pretty powerful. The Navajos, Peter MacDonald, I've chatted with him not too long ago, and he talked about some of the some sort of iron ore or uranium or something that he has under his earth. Well, here in Florida, the Seminole tribe owns a piece of land out there that we're still working with in a little lawsuit or trading going on, and it just happens to be the water table of Florida. Every place that the Seminole tribe lives today lives in an area where it would be the furthest away that they will never hinder the Caucasians' movement. So when they put us here on this reservation, it was the furthest point out, so it will never be an eyesore to the Caucasians. But it just so happens we're right in the middle of it and have a tobacco road here and enjoying the hell out of it. Big Cypress, again, we have the... it was a swamp... it's not devastated, it's a beautiful land, but yeah. It was high water. And only a few Indians at that time. What possibly can an Indian do with his land? So they gave us swampland. Lo and behold, we just happened to have the water table of Florida. I'll put cyanide or something in there. I don't know. But anyway, those type of things. So 1957, when we became organized, what happened is now they're going to give us health. They promised us health, education, welfare, social services, some sort of economic development gains, and we borrowed a couple $1 million to make an Indian village over here. From our Indian way of, this is 1957, one point back, the things that I told you from the beginning, if you was a good hunter, if you was a good this and that, every craft of the trade, you was really something. In 57, you still continued on, but at that point, they said education will be your priority. I don't care what happens, how rich you get, you got to educate to know what's happening from this day forth. So I was a product of it. The other people, that's, I'm 37 now, so anybody that's 37 forward, some of them would have went to the wayside, keeping their tradition and keeping that intact. We used, you know, I remember laughing at some of my own people my age at that time, whatever it was, 12, 9 years old, who didn't go to school except learn Indian way. And I said, you poor fool, I'm going to get advantage of you one day. So you know what we're doing with those guys now? He's getting more money than I get for consulting work to teach us the old way. Thank God.
Yeah.
But I laughed at something one day and admired him the next day. And so that's taking place. So we get all these type of things, and I think they gave 25-year stretch to catch up thousands and thousands of years in that so many years span, but it can be done just by going to school and learning the world's history, the same things you was accustomed to. So now I feel like I'm probably just at the same level as some people that would be sitting across from me, or maybe higher. The only thing I don't have is the cash that's sitting at Fort Knox type situation to go to help me acquire achieve what I want. So so the United States doesn't really have to be looking at me as a threat. But what has happened, if I can't threaten the United States, one way I've got to make some money. So what happens? Things like, you know, somebody tells us this, and people like some Fort Lauderdale News or Miami Herald type people, some people on the staff would love to see Indians still out there living in Chiquis, wrestling gators and begging for money. I don't mind doing it, but I better be paid awful lot, because I want to live in a jet age too. So, again, talking about somebody who has an idea and you steal their idea, or you take their idea, or you work together on an idea to accomplish one thing is to make the bucks. Well, I'm not ashamed of that. The Anglo-Saxons did it for a billion or however many years we've been on. So, tobacco sales came on. Bingo came on. How the heck to achieve all these things sometimes is not the nicest things on earth. Anglo-Saxon didn't give a damn what the hell they did. A few people floating down Alligator Canal all the time. Who the hell knows? CIA might have done that. But anyway, same thing. But we haven't made a dent in the United States economy. Matter of fact, we might have promoted the state of Florida by people, tourists coming into Florida. We got some money. The harassment that I get sometimes, I make it sound like when I make my money here that I run off to Europe or Japan or Russia, let's say, for instance, and take my $1 million and go spend it. I go right over here to the local bank, put it in it. It never circulates on my reservation, so what the hell are they bitching about? You can strike that if you want to, but what gets me is the money that we make here just went right over here. I spent to buy a pair of pants, but what what is a pair of Levi's going to cost the United States? Not a darn thing. So we do make money, and we're advancing ourselves, and however anybody wants to look at it, from the economy that we developed from a ground that was making flat zero to $1.8 million, almost $2 million a year, we're kind of tickled with it. But sometimes you may have to make sacrifices.
Yeah.
And so it's a long stretch from what I've been trying to tell you.
Well, I think it's true that you've made great strides as far as your economic development. You're more of a self-help program than anything else, because you've done it yourself. We haven't come in and said, put a bingo hall and you'll make money. You've thought this out yourself. You've been able to figure it out. Well, yeah, but I mean, it's not something the government came in and said, do this and you'll make money. But the thing is something that I wonder about is that I feel this, your tribe has a lot to offer as far as your cultural heritage goes. To us, we did not grow up, like you say, feeling the sand underneath our feet. we grew up in a totally, maybe the jet age, we grew up in a totally different way, but now we're starting to sit back and say, hey, you know, as far as our ecology goes, like you say, our water table, everything, everything's going so fast and building up. All of a sudden, we're at a stopping point because there's nowhere to go now but to start looking back at some of the other ways of living. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think your tribe has a lot to offer us as far as...
I'm the worst guy to talk about, try to promote something like that. I know there's a few other Seminole boys on the reservation that probably could take that and have a good heyday with it and
tell me if you disagree.
Boast about it, but my problem is I've been out in the woods a lot. Who lives out, who truly lives off the land right now? I was out in the swamp the other day. There's a man living out there right now who just happened to be a Seminole. He isn't a Seminole Indian, but who does that? I got a couple boys that's not Indian on my staff over here at my village who aren't Seminole, but they live closer to the earth than Indian himself today because the Indian himself has gotten accustomed to something else. I don't know too many Indians today that goes and get a pup tent out of Kmart or something, goes out and pitch it up and enjoy the weekend. Touching the earth and feeling and walking around barefooted. I don't know too many Indians that walk around barefooted today.
No.
But there's a, I'm talking about before 57 sort of attitude. There's a few people probably. Very little, but there's a lot of human beings in Florida that lives closer to the earth than my people do in today's sense.
Well,
because we were more impressed by the everybody's Howard Hughes style living.
Yeah.
I remember some of the old men used to walk down the road and would rather look like Randolph Scott instead of looking like himself because it was better to look like him. I know some people would like some guys on the road that would rather look like Alice Cooper the way he dresses up and walk around every day. They like that. Mm-hmm. But I've never seen him walking around the traditional way too much. Yeah. Matter of fact, I've never seen an Indian group anywhere in the state of Florida promoting their Indian way of living because they would prefer to wear coat and tie.
Well, what do you think is important to keep alive then?
Well, the traditions we do, we want to maintain that. And it was probably the same thing that Bob Mueller was probably talking about. Matter of fact, nobody put any money into the cultural enrichments or cultural heritage program until I came in and took advantage of my position to do that. If nobody else does, who is? So we want to maintain these things and teach our little ones because you can instill it in a little child's head quicker than some guy who's already polluted with some type of barbiturates or something in his head, you know. So I want to pick these children up and start teaching them. And now the older ones want to come, they're just going to have to come and at a certain time. But the youth is the one I'm concentrating on now while we still have elders with us. That's very important, but it takes money to do that. I went to some Republican man one time to go off on a different tangent. I asked him, hey, I know you got some cultural enrichment monies. We'd like to get some of that to develop new things out here. And he's a Republican now. And the app scam called him, too, and I had to laugh my head off. He's a local Florida congressman at the time. He says, why don't you people just get together and go build all these things? He's right in one sense, but it just so happens 1,500 people, not everybody thinks the same.
Yeah.
1,500 people is a lot of people in one little group of people, but I like to go do something else. This other guy does this. This other guy does this. When you break them all down into families, it's only 400 families to make 1,500 people. Out of a million people, you'll find one benevolent person out of Miami here and there to come over and say, we want to do this for you. But out of 1,500 people against 3 million people, give me a break. And I'm not even asking for a break. But just a sensitive word. So, cultural enrichment, some sort of mental attitude change towards what the person is to figure himself out instead of giving me the sorry attitude, the white man this and white man that in a derogatory way. When I say white man, it's generally playing with the name. Like you call me Indian all day long, why can't I say you're a white man? But I've seen some white people get offended by the term being called white person. And, but he calls me Indian all day long in the United States and the papers. And right away, I'm not an Indian. I never touched the shores of India yet. I'm a Miccosukee Indian, part Irish. And then we're tagged with the name Seminole. But to call me an Indian would be an insult, but we let the poor guys go. Yet he'll get insulted and say, hey, white man, he'll get mad. But anyway, the importance of our culture to survive as long as it can survive, or to know it in the books if that's where it has to go to, but it can be revived. We can record it just like you're doing now, and if we can put it on paper just like somebody will do, and then get the designs and drawings of how everything was done. If we fail to keep it up in the next several years, there will be an interested party in the years down the road to reestablish that. But I doubt if we'll ever get there. I used to think we were going to lose our language. There's no way I think we're going to ever lose our language. That's knock on wood again. But there's quite a few kids. Like about 75% of our people is speaking Indian now. So, you know, the other small group is... It was our fault, like one of my daughters. Somehow, I neglected to teach her Indian, so her she's fluent in English and everything. She has trouble speaking Indian. She'll be just like any ordinary kid in the United States that does all he knows is English. If he's Irish or French, he doesn't know a darn word in French except parlez-vous français or something. That would be it. That's about the way my daughter is. There's a lot of people like that around here. Mm-hmm. So I guess 75, that might be high, 50% maybe.
So this is one of the things that the Cultural Heritage Program can do.
Is to maintain the language and to preserve, try to understand what the Indian, how he explained a certain situation instead of trying to explain it in English situation, because it takes a total meaning. It's like if I said an Indian, Hastanagit, if I have to go to North Pole, I go Hashnan, in Indian I would go north. And that's it. Somehow I know which way to go. I look at the star, and there's a Polaris up there where the Big Dipper is, and then there's one star over here. They would tell me in Indian to follow that. And if I followed it, and every time I see it, I keep going, I may reach North Pole somewhere. But if I told a non-Indian, he would say, you take a 360-degree azimuth with a little deviation as you go, and you both get there the same. But one of them has a little different meaning, while another has a different color to it. So that's about the only thing.
I remember when I came in here last time, you had a beautiful painting.
I took it over to my village. It's at my village.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, the others I loaned it to... Secretary George Firestone for his office, so that's where it's at. So it's on display right now, and I'll pick him up this month.
Well, what can you tell me again? What was the story that
the story behind the one that you called? That was a twofold story. My life isn't one of the most perfect thing on earth, but people can throw darts at me, throw trash on me, and I'll just walk right on through it. And that was one symbolism for myself there, and I could walk on a narrow path. Well, you can ride a car and I'll be on this little dirty path, but I'll achieve what I want while you probably get a flat tire and still remain. The legend of the story that you saw was a bridge to eternity is what we called it. And that's our belief, just like if you die, you go to heaven or go to hell. Well, in our Indian way, we believe that when we die, and if you're properly prepared when you die, is that like while you're still alive, you take the sponge of a dog fennel, which is a weed, and you set that on your arm and you let it burn till it sizzles itself out. It's not a psychopathic type attitude. It was a religion. Okay, so it sizzles itself out and makes a scar. We believe that if you die, that will glow because the bridge to eternity is very dark and you need illumination somehow. So your arms will glow and it'll show you the pathway. The other way when you die is they'll bury you with your head towards the west, and then about 4 feet away from the casket, they'll place fire. Okay? And when the proper time comes, within the 4 days, There's a cycle of life that the soul arises out of the body, and it's in that stretch of 4 days somewhere. The soul will get up and pick up what's necessary that he needs to get on the pathway to bridge to eternity. And you know it's dark, so he gets up illumination, mm-hmm. and he carries it and goes across. Underneath the bridge, it's a light. I don't know how to picture it, except it must have been a suspended type pathway going there, no sides, and if you slip, you'll fall into the serpent pit. The serpents will devour it, and you'll never make it. The idea is not to slip into the serpent pit. You want to make it to the other side. And that's what that picture was about.
Mm-hmm.
But on it, my favorite stars was on it, the Big Dipper and Polaris.
Uh-huh. Who painted that?
Guy Labrie. He's not an Indian. He's a non-Indian. He's one of my favorite artists. It's only in the sense that he... I've talked to my own Indian people. Bob Motlow is a good artist. And his family is pretty well gifted at that. There's other people that's gifted at him. But who could draw these pictures better than anybody else? If I was an Indian artist, I could do all these things. But it just so happens I'm just not the one of the best. When I do mine, a first grader could outdraw me. But anyway, this non-Indian, somehow I could tell him the story. And fortunately for me, he had lived and grew up with the Indians here on this reservation. He still walks around barefooted, so we call him the barefooted painter. He's still, maybe it's because he can't find a pair of shoes, I don't know. But anyway, it's...
can't afford it.
Yeah, can't afford it. He's a painter. But Guy is an artistic person that if I told him a picture of what I want,
mm-hmm.
wow, he will go beyond my imagination and it'll look so damn realistic that I can't believe it.
And one other person I think of who's got that gift is Will McLean. As far
on paper or drawing?
As far as
in words. Verbal world.
Yeah.
Yes, Will Music. McLean. I love that old man. That's the old bear.
Yeah.
When I first started into folk music, started singing all this thing, somewhere a friend introduced me to a record. He didn't say not formally. I mean, you know, just putting it on. He says, Jim, the kind of songs you write and sing, I think you're going to like somebody, which may quit make you stop writing. I said, what do you mean? I want to hear it. Lo and behold, I heard it, and I said, I don't want to write no more songs. I just want to pick up the guy, let him write the songs, and let me, those songs belong to me as far as I'm concerned. And they fit every mood that I like.
Uh-huh.
And he's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I know I heard you sing Seminole.
Yeah.
And it was terrific because I could tell you... You could really. It was yours. Yeah. It was yours. And
well, he wrote it, but it's mine. I don't give a
shit. Yeah. But he does have that way with words, like this other man has with painting, and they're able to capture that.
Yeah.
Let me see. I don't want to keep you too long because I know you're really busy. You are the chairman after all.
Yeah, you see, I'm really busy. People knocking on my door.
No, you got your TV here, and you may need to sit up your feet and think about these things now. But I do have just a few more questions. You told a story when we were at the Folk Festival, and I was hoping you might tell the story for the tape. And it was a story about the rabbit, and I'm trying to think now.
The bear.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, there was somebody told me the other day, they were up in New York. These stories, since there was a lot of true Seminoles here in Florida,
mm-hmm.
Cimarrones.
Oh, yeah.
Did some of these stories come together with what you call the Seminoles from Africa or the Indian? But anyway, there was a black man up in New York who told the exact story per verbatim without ever meeting my people. And I'm trying, and if I could recall who in the heck told me that, I'm going to spend me a few bucks and go up there, and I'm hoping that he will say, yeah, I was down in Florida back in 1929 and I heard the Indians tell it. But from what, I think it was my brother-in-law, darn it, if it is, I'll ask him today how I can get a hold of this man, because Alan Jabor or somebody was sponsoring this cultural thing up in D.C. just recently. Mm-hmm. During the summertime, they always do that. And this black man told a story, and my brother-in-law said he was shocked to hear it. And he asked him, has he ever met an Indian in Florida? He says, I never was raised there, never was born there. My family never been down there. They came from Africa many years ago, and they always lived in the New England states.
Interesting how that...
Yeah.
Which so, came first?
Well, anyway, this is a story about the bear and the rabbit. And it's a... It's an analytical type story where the child is told these stories when they're small. And the child, in turn, throughout the years, without realizing it, maybe in his train of thinking, figures out the riddle, what the riddle is. Well, James Billy just happens to be one of the more intelligent kids, you know. And his mother told James when he was little these stories. And then his grandmother reinforced it after his mother died, you know. And again, he's a little intelligent white kid, they used to call him. And it generally takes a kid a short period of time to figure these things out. Well, it took Jim Billy about 34 years old to figure out this riddle, to show you how intelligent he is. I couldn't believe, I was kind of insulted at myself that why it took me so darn long. I'm a late bloomer. But anyway, the story goes that one afternoon the rabbit was going through the woods, and happened to be a lot of huckleberry around, so he'd stop off and nibble at a berry, and he's not a very fond of berries. He eats a lot of grass, but the reason why he stopped by to munch on a little huckleberry because there was a big old bear out in the field. He didn't stop by, and the rabbit, boy, he's just an inquisitive type of a fella, you know, and always playing tricks or something, good deeds. He was doctor, lawyer, medicine man. He was the biggest thief around, and that's probably why he was such an intelligent person. He just had no particular habits. Everything was a habit for him to do. Well, somehow he got over to the bear, and little by little crept up on the bear and started chatting with him, little small talk, till it developed into a good, friendly conversation. And to the point where the bear was impressed by the rabbit, and they went to his house. Or he was invited, and when that day came, the rabbit arrived at his house, so he went over to his hut, mm-hmm. and yelled out, and the bear answered and told him to come on in. So they went inside, and they were talking away a little bit, and small talk about how their past lives has been. And finally the bear said, well, I think I'll prepare something to eat and a little bit of drink. So the bear had some sofki already brewed up, so he gave him some sofki, and the old rabbit sipped on a little bit, and they both talked a little bit, and then the bear got up and said, I'll cook us something, let's eat. He says, okay. So the bear went out there, got a sharp knife, and stuck it to his stomach and cut it. Didn't even flinch. Rabbit was sitting there in horror. Oh, that must hurt, he thought. And rabbit kind of scuffled around in there a little bit and cut out a big chunk of fat. Laid it on a table, and somehow it healed back up. And the bear started cooking, and the rabbit was still amazed and didn't know what the heck was going on, except that he knew there was going to be food prepared, so that overwhelmed his thinking, and he was ready to eat. Bear finally cooked the food, and they sat there and eating, and somewhere down the line, the rabbit had forgotten how he did it, and he went on ahead and ate the food, and then enjoyed it, and again, a little small talk, drank some softkin, and the rabbit said, you know, this is really kind of you. You would give me a piece of your body, and we enjoy and drink our food, and I think there's no friend on this earth could do that, and at the same time let me enjoy. So just for that, I tell you, let's meet at my place next time, and we'll eat. So they set the date. So days went by, and that date arrived, and the bear finally found a location in the most ridiculous place that you could find where a bear generally doesn't go hanging around. And there was kind of a saw grassy, thorny area. And finally the bear managed to get in there. And they sat down and talked for a while and drank some sofki and some sort of greenery that the rabbit likes to eat. And the bear fortunately eats those things. And the bear told him that how he enjoys meat, how he enjoys greeneries. And if it gets to the point where he can't eat meat, he can always stay on green stuff. Or if he can't, if nature can't provide nothing, no green stuff, he can just live off of meat. It doesn't really matter to him. He just a good old boy. But the rabbit does not eat meat. So they discussed that for a little while. And so time came by. The rabbit says, I'll prepare something to eat. So he did the same thing. He went over there and cut himself, and his intestine just plumb fell out. Oh, 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 he said. And he fell on the floor, and he was hurting and just in agony. And the bear thought, oh, my God, what is the matter with him? He went over there and looked at it, and his intestine was on the floor, so he told him to push it together, hold it there, and I'm going to go find us a doctor. So he ran off into the woods on a trail and started going down, and lo and behold, there was an old dead tree and a buzzard sitting up there looking down at him. And well, the bear was just panting away, yelling and screaming. The buzzard somehow got his head. What's the matter down there? He says, my friend just cut himself and his intestines is all on the floor, and I'm going to find a doctor to give him some help. Why, I know what I can do. I'm a medicine man myself. I can help that old boy. So the bear was so happy to hear somebody said that he was a doctor or a medicine man. So he says, show me the way. So the buzzard flew off in the direction and the bear led. They finally got there, and the buzzard stepped down and looked at it and saw the interesting situation that he could take a good situation, got it into a good hand, you know. So he thought to himself, well, the bear said, what can I do to help? He said, just make me a little round wall here made of palmetto leaves and saplings and leave the top open so I can see. So, okay. So the bear did that. Went and got hustled and bustled, got some saplings, made a little round pit, kind of with palmetto fronds around it with an open top.